Well, tell me about you. Where do you come from?
Well, I was born and raised in California, San Francisco, and kind of found myself in Washington about 22 years ago.
How did that happen?
It fairly organically. I went east to college, and then I met the person I ultimately married, who then decided he wanted to be a lawyer, who then went to Georgetown Law School. And my best friend, who introduced us, was also from Washington, Barbara Boggs, who's now Barbara Sigmund and the mayor of Princeton. Everybody's risen to great political heights here. And at any rate, I used to stay a lot with her family in Washington. And so it was a very natural thing when my then-husband decided to go to Georgetown for me to want to do that, too, and live in Washington. So that's where we sort of put down our roots.
So you stayed, huh?
Yeah, once I tried to make a break for it and move back to California, and I did everything but actually transport us all out there. This is about 3 or 4 years ago, and I realized when I got back to California, I was no longer a Californian. I took one look and thought to myself, these aren't my people anymore. So I moved right back.
Well, you certainly made the right choice.
I think so. Ever since I was small, I was looking for a way to get out of California. Most people are looking for a way to get in. But, you know, I kept thinking, good Lord, you know, to the west is the Pacific Ocean, to the south is deserts, to the north are two states I can never remember which order they come in, and then there are the Sierras on the eastern side. I thought I'd never get out, but I finally found the key to it when I went to college.
Well, as an adopted New Yorker now, after 20 years in the Big Apple, I guess I have grown to harbor this resentment that New Yorkers have, not resentment, I guess, contempt. I guess this is the contempt that New Yorkers have for places like California.
I don't have contempt for it. I think
you're not a New Yorker.
True, but I think
if you were a New Yorker, you'd have contempt.
Would I? I think everyone should be born in such a beautiful place as California. I mean, really, think about it. To be born in San Francisco and reared by the Pacific Ocean with all those sequoias and eucalyptus trees, fog.
And then you can leave.
once I've got my values straight, then I'm free to leave. Right.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
No. I didn't at all. I grew up in... I wrote about this in my first book called California and Other States of Grace, which came out about 6 years ago, sort of a memoir. I grew up in a very idealistic family. But their reading tended to be fairly narrow. They tended to read religious and philosophical people. Or, with the exception of my father, thank God, he read a lot of Thurber. So I got a little balance.
Well, that's not too bad. I grew up in a household. The only books we have are Reader's Digest condensed books.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Did it ever make you want to sort of go and find the uncondensed versions, or did you think all books were condensed?
At least they were books.
Yeah.
What I didn't know at the time was, the Reader's Digest sanitizes its condensations.
Oh, so all the good stuff was left out?
All the good stuff is left out.
Listen.
There was never any profanity. Any sex scenes ended with the bedroom door closing. You never
well, you know, that. It's funny because I have a good friend by the name of Mr. Olson, who's 75 years old, and he's a very religious person. And I gave him my first book to read, and I really, you know, just mentally went through it and couldn't think of a thing that he would take offense to. But at one point I did say a swear word that begins with G, and he read the book.
What was it, gosh?
Three letters, referring to the deity. And I was gardening one day in this little cooperative garden that he was sort of the unofficial president of, and he came by and he said, you know, Phyllis, I was getting along pretty good in your book until I came across some profanity. I said, Mr. Olson, I don't remember any profanity in the book. Well, what was the word? And he said, well, I prefer not to mention it. And I said, well, could you spell it? So he spelled it, G-O-D, and I said, oh, you know, you're right. I hate to tell you this, Mr. Olson, but in real life I've said worse. And he just looked at me and he said, well, you're going to lose a lot of people if you use profanity. And he sort of marched off into the distance.
How many people do you think you lost?
I don't know. You don't usually hear from those people.
Tell me about your first published work.
Well, the first one was a memoir. that was essentially what I just said about growing up and out of California. And the second book was a collection of essays that called Peripheral Visions, which was sort of a random collection. I didn't have a particular theme. And this third one is a not random collection of essays on the art or horrors of being a parent.
No, it's not random. It's Viking.
Aha, I didn't mean random in that sense. I meant, sorry. Right, by Viking. But it's a collection of essays on being a parent.
Now, many of these essays first appeared in Parents Magazine, right?
Yes, I'm a columnist for Parents, and not an expert on parenthood, but a columnist for the magazine. And some of them appeared in the New York Times or the Washington Post, and some have appeared nowhere.
Now, you've had three children. I'd like to ask you, is anybody with three children, or one child, or two children, or even more, is anybody like that an expert on parenting? Is there such a thing?
As an expert on parenting? Well, a lot of friends of mine have said you only get good at it after it's too late. You know, all the things that you're finally good at or get good at tend to coincide with a snap of the last suitcase as they're walking out the door. So, yes, I guess there are experts on parenthood, but sort of retrospective experts, I would say, not while you're doing it.
I don't believe there's an expert on parenting because people interact with each other. For example, your children all act as individuals. I think you there's one line in which you refer to your daughter, and she says, "Now, when she stops hating me."
That's right.
And kids always go through this. And,
well, you know, are there any experts?
Are the temper tantrums when you have a scenario and getting a kid to go to a party or something like that? And so you play things by ear.
Well, think of this. Have you ever interviewed a child and said, "Do you consider yourself an expert on childhood?" No such thing.
Right.
So why should there be an expert on parenthood?
My point exactly.
Yeah, I took off from your point.
You might be able to have an expert on parenting if people were as static as numbers. So you can have a mathematical expert, even a chess expert. But
right.
When you're dealing with emotions like...
Well, they're living organisms. I mean, even somebody who's an expert on gardens, every once in a while there's a Japanese beetle that comes in and confounds them. But anything alive, and ergo uncontrollable, is going to... There's going to be an aura or an element of mystery in dealing with it.
Now, you make reference to raising the children mostly as a single parent. Mm-hmm. This does cause an extra burden, doesn't it?
Well, earlier today somebody asked me, or somebody made the comment, "You've really done this alone," or "How has it felt," or "How has it been to raise your children alone?" And I was sort of glad the question was asked, because, in fact, I have not done it alone. And I don't think anybody can do anything alone, much less raise children. Very rarely do I feel alone, even though, obviously, I have not had a partner by my side to sort of fill in. But in a way, this book, Nightlights, ought to, in some way, cause people to realize that we really do need each other, that a family cannot be defined as itself any longer. We really do have to expand our definition. I mean, the people whose mercy I've fallen upon over the years in raising my children are legion. I mean, they wouldn't fit into a whole book.
But the children's father played a role throughout this period.
Yes.
Did he not? I mean, he wasn't completely absent, even though he was completely absent.
Well, I think that this is my book about raising children, and I'd feel more comfortable just... I tend to write from personal experience.
But you said a moment ago you didn't do it alone, even though you acted as a single parent.
Well, by that I mean there were teachers, there were friends, there were the occasional policemen on the beat. All kinds of people have had a role in helping my children to go from day one to the ages they are now. And I just never did feel alone in the sense that there weren't people that I could call upon to help me.
Well, now, if you could stretch your memory a little bit, maybe we could talk about some of the episodes in the book.
Sure.
A moment, if you're
sure.
Sure you remember all this stuff, or has it been blotted out of your mind?
I think so.
All right. Well, let's start with The facts of life.
Uh-huh.
That's always a good topic. I'm in my early middle age now, but I'm still interested in the facts of life, so tell me about them.
Well,
they apply to you and the kids.
Were there some questions that particular essay raised in your mind about the facts of life? Do we need to review the facts of life as they are currently known by all generations?
Well, how does one explain the facts of life to a young person without embarrassing herself?
Well, I found that I thought I was going to really be the enlightened mother, and before my children got to an age where they might be self-conscious about it, I would be blabbed on for so long about, you know, how people have babies and how wonderful it is, that it would just be sort of teaching them by osmosis, like tying their shoes. They'd sort of grow up knowing about the facts of life, and I wouldn't be faced with the sort of nightmare of finding out that they'd learned it, quote, on the streets. And so I would buy tasteful library books, and we'd read them when they were 5 and 6 and 7, and I'd draw diagrams on the sides of bathtubs if the subject came up while their little ones were taking their baths together, and everything was proceeding apace, and they really kind of got lost interest in it. And so I thought I was doing my job fine, and then I realized that, you know, the facts of life did not just involve the sort of mechanics of sex, and that I overheard my older son explaining to my younger son what a particularly popular word in the English language was, and I had to admit that he had it exactly right, although it didn't have much philosophical overlay to it. And I said, "Where did you learn about that word?" And he looked at me and he said, "On the streets, where everybody learns it."
He probably heard it from Mr. Olson.
No, not Mr. Olson. And I realized that the streets are the streets. They're there. They're going to find out certain things no matter how carefully you try to sort of make sure that all the important things in life are found out from you first.
Well, I always thought the streets were where you were supposed to find these things out. It's kind of like a computer in a way. You know, I bought a computer about 3 years ago, and a manual showed me how to run it. And mm-hmm. Could never figure out the manual very well, and never had a course in computer technology or anything. But I would bump into somebody, and we'd be talking, you know, and he said, "Oh, well, you're supposed to do this with that." And, you know, eventually I would put mm-hmm. together how to run this computer only by talking to people on the street. Now, sex is kind of like that, too, in a way.
Or making an apple pie, for that matter. I mean, I learned how to make an apple pie by having someone, you know, basically demonstrate in the kitchen. Well, there is a sort of a lab section.
I remembered when I was very young, maybe 12, 13, 11, something like that, we were driving through Oklahoma, and we stopped at a gas station and went to the bathroom, and there was a box on the wall, and it advertised, I don't know what it advertised, and I don't know what you put a quarter in the machine, you know, and you got something. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Dad, what is this? What is this? I mean, what do you get in this?" And my father said, "I'll tell you later." Well, now I'm 50, and my father is 78.
He
and I am
still hasn't told
for him
you
to tell me.
Well, maybe he was praying that the streets would help him out.
It did. he was right. You find out on the street. Well, let's.
You know, it's funny that you would mention that, because I remember my younger son telling me that he had gone into one of the men's rooms at some restaurant, and he'd found he had seen this box, and he that sold condoms, and I said, "Do you know what these are for?" And he said, "Yes, they're for people that love each other, but not enough to have babies." And I said, "Well, that's not inaccurate." And he said, "And if they do love each other, then they don't use them, and they carry on with the experiment." I thought that was quite...
All right, let me flip through here.
Someone once asked me why I'm an essayist, and it's because I think in some ways, raising three children, 1,200 words was about all I would ever have time to write before life intervened and I had to jump up.
There was one, I don't know if it's a title, it was about you're getting mad. And how you, oh, here, yeah, it was a title.
On Getting Mad,
yes,
that's right.
On page 99. How one does have a right to become angry, especially with your children. How does one cope with it?
Well, one of the main thrust of that essay is that I felt, and I didn't realize it actually until I was in the middle of writing that essay, that as a single parent, I had to take double the amounts of frustration and irritation or whatever it was that was dished out because there was only one person. It was a very odd way to do math, but I kind of conceived of myself as the equivalent of a rubber room in which my children could hurl themselves without harm, but that I should always demonstrate peace, equanimity, and even temperedness. And it took me a while to realize that that just simply taught my children that I could take anything. And for a long time I did. I would get mad, but it would really take a lot to set me off. And it wasn't in my children's interest to ask why. So that's one of the things that you sort of learn as you get older. I tended to, if a line was crossed by one of my children, I would just take the chalk and draw the circle around me a little closer. And I'd keep doing that and keep doing that until finally I had no space left and I would explode. But I don't do that anymore, or try not to.
Well, it's good that that you can send the signal out that mom is on the warpath.
Yeah, they don't know where they stand otherwise. I'm still not good at getting angry. It's just not my long suit. But I've encouraged it in my children because I was not allowed to get angry when I was growing up.
Now, there was another essay that I liked, Matter of Style, page 119.
Style.
Style. You grew up in a family that emphasized substance.
Well, what I meant by that is that they did have a style, but it was very, very conventional. And there's nothing wrong with being conventional, but I really had no notion of what was ahead of me in the style department as far as children were concerned. I sort of pictured them going from smocked dresses to Shetland sweaters, and that was that. And for the boys, going from little Buster Brown suits to coats and ties. And there was this whole middle range that I was just not prepared for, where you use starch in your hair and you shop at thrift shops, and the larger and baggier the clothes, the better. And the prison guard look was one that had a long run in our household, where everybody thought they looked terribly attractive if they wore black and shades of gray. And
your son hasn't discovered earrings yet, or has he?
Hasn't. We're beyond. We're post earrings.
Oh yeah, there is something like that. Tell me, what comes next?
Well, no, actually, he still has one little discreet hoop in one ear. But we were into iron crosses, and I don't know. I mean, he was going to be hanging whole clotheslines off his ears at one point. But
that's strange. I have an 18-year-old. He wears an iron cross when he's getting dressed up. That's his dressy earring.
Or two or three in one ear. I mean, the crisis would come when there'd be something like a family wedding, and I just wasn't willing to show up with three children that looked, well, two, the one, my oldest, has always looked very sort of conservative. But the other two have, you know, they accuse me of looking like, my daughter said, well, you know, I wouldn't want to look like you. Your style is style for a dead person. Or the Holly Hobby look is the other look that she thinks I'm big on.
Now, there was one thing that I was amused by. It was I can't remember which essay it is, but it was the one in which you had a kind of a four-part scenario when you wanted to take children to a party that they didn't want to go to, usually a family holiday party.
That's right.
And tell me about that.
Well, I think parties are very important, both to give and have your children in attendance, and to go to also with your children in attendance. Because one thing, I think children sort of start out thinking that they can't possibly relate to anyone except someone that's either their age, rank, and serial number, or certainly not to adults. And if they're going to grow up into adults, they're going to have to learn that the world is full of interesting, odd, sometimes unpleasant, but mostly interesting people. And I think a party is a good place to learn that, sort of a controlled environment. But I sort of classify any parties that we're invited to in, I think it's four different ways. The first category of party is, I'd like you to go, but it's not mandatory. The second category is, I'd like you to go for my sake. The third category is, I'd like you to go, and I'll be rather upset if you don't. And the fourth is, I'd like you to go, and if you don't, I'll hold it against you for the rest of your life.
Which the shout is, that's blackmail.
Yeah, to which I say, whatever. And that's when I know I can get a full car to the event.
There's one touching story about Bartholomew.
Ah, Bartholomew O'Hara, yes.
Tell me about Bartholomew.
Well, I just left my house the other day. Bartholomew was currently watching our dog and cat, and I said, Bartholomew, I'm going up to New York to...
You better explain the age of
Bartholomew. To pave your way to fame and fortune. Bartholomew, I think, is now 12. I may have that age wrong. If you're listening, Bartholomew, forgive me. When I first knew him, he was 10, and he was the son of Judy and Bartley O'Hara, who were neighbors of mine, who I hadn't known too well until we moved into that neighborhood, and then I got to know the O'Hara children vaguely, because I'd drop in and sit on their porch and talk to the parents. And then one night, in the summer, I went away for a vacation. When I came back, there was Bartholomew on my front door asking if I'd like to come over tonight and visit his parents on the porch. I thought it was sort of an odd request, but I took it at face value, and I called his mother and said, I'd love to, but I've just gotten back from this trip. Why don't you come over here? And she said, well, we'll do that after we finish the dishes, but actually it was Bartholomew who's been pacing the floor waiting for you to return. I hung up the phone, and I thought to myself, my goodness, this little 10-year-old boy has actually focused on me, and from what his parents said, considered me a friend, someone to miss even when I left for a week. So that was sort of the beginning of getting to know Bartholomew, and he told me that he was an artist, and I asked if I could see some of his pictures, and he brought them over, and they were really quite good. And he allowed us how he wouldn't mind if I had several of them on loan for a couple of weeks in my living room. So I said, thank you very much. I'd love to do that. And 2 weeks later, he came back, and he said, tell me truthfully, which one do you like best? And I said, well, I think I like the one with the wine bottle. I should add, I forgot to put this part in the story, that he told me he oftentimes gave away his pictures. And I said, well, that's very nice of you, Bartholomew. He said, no, not really. He said, I only give them to people who I'm pretty sure will give me back some later on. So here we are looking at his two paintings. And I said, I think I like the one with the wine bottle best. And he said, well, then it's yours. And I said, but Bartholomew, I haven't given you anything. And he said, yes, you have. You moved into the neighborhood. And I was so touched, and I wanted to sort of protest and do all the things that grown-ups or adults want to do. And I decided, no, I was going to just let that one lie, and I was going to take the compliment and thank him, which I did. It's just been the beginning of a very nice friendship.
Well, I think the listener has some comprehension of what your life is like and the... certainly an element of sanity in your life as you deal with problems of raising children and existing and writing about them. In some respects, did you read Delia Ephron's book? What was it called?
Funny Sauce?
Funny Sauce.
That's a wonderful book in many ways.
It reminds me a little bit of that, except that she had...
the element of the step. Parent.
She had. She was more entrenched in her existence than you, but...
I'm pretty entrenched.
What's that?
What do you mean she was more entrenched?
Well, she was more entrenched because she was played, in effect, against... she was considered the stepmother.
As in Cinderella.
Yeah,
right.
The children used her in one way or another. But yet, she also talked about everyday things in her life. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we don't articulate these very well. I mean, we take them for granted, and we don't look at what's around us. That's really... quite good, like your story about Bartholomew. I mean, all of us have probably had an episode in our lives where a young person in the neighborhood becomes our friend, and
we
forget about it.
I think you don't forget about it. That's what a writer does, is put into words what other people feel but either don't have the words to articulate. But it's there. It's there. You felt these things. In a way, that's what the writer does, is just kind of put flesh on things that you already knew.
When are we going to have some fiction from you?
I don't know if you're ever going to have any fiction. You know, my children's father makes up stories wonderfully. I used to listen to him tell bedtime stories to our children and marvel at his capacity to weave stories out of empty air. I tend to be better at seeing stories that are right in front of me. and doing something with them, making them sound a little fictional, perhaps. But in fact, what I write is straight off the old drawing board of life. But, you know, as far as writing a book about children and or parents, I think the reason why one writes about the joys of parenthood as well as the sorrows and the mysteries of it, as opposed to the joys of being a CPA, is that it's just a huge vocation. And my theory is that parents would never grow up unless there were children on the scene. We would never really reach our full height unless we had children, because they're so challenging. What do you think?
Well, I would disagree, because I have found child raising a very unpleasant experience, especially since my kid is 18 going on 8.
Uh-huh.
And he has given us a remarkably bad experience going through adolescence, which is, I don't think any parent should have to go through adolescence. I mean, not the parents' adolescence, but the children's adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a difficult stage, and it's
very right.
difficult for us. So I'm not sure
Well, I don't think what you're saying is really contradicts what I'm saying either. I think there's a part, I know that with my children, and particularly one of them, there has come a point where I've had to draw a line and say, I can no longer be responsible for your life. You have to say that with all your children one way or the other, but with some children, you've got to really say it, sometimes to the point of packing their bags and saying, all right, we've done as much as we know how to do. Good luck. There are so many different kinds of kids and kinds of parents, and I know just what you're saying. You can be sapped to the point where you just think, I'm not even a tree anymore. Forget the sap. The tree is being decimated.
Well, by the same token, I have friends of one that I just talked to a moment ago, called just as you sat down,
mm-hmm.
who has three children. They're college age and above now, and he had a remarkably good experience
mm-hmm.
with them, and they're all working or going to school and doing positive things.
Well, you know, there's an essay in this book on perfect families. I don't know if you got a chance to read that one, but there comes a time where all kids realize, or most kids realize, that the family they've got as opposed to the one they want are two different things. I sort of go through the various kinds of perfect families that I'm able to deal with, but then there are families.
Well, this essay, as I recall, it was the one in which that family looked so perfect, and then
mm-hmm.
the family got a divorce, and the mother was killed in an automobile crash.
Well, that was a part of the essay. It's true. That was my first perfect family that I'd ever run into.
That was that's right. It was that you had run into.
And and when it all fell apart, I was very sad, because in a way it sort of made me think there is no such thing. But, you know, when there are plenty of families that, no family is perfect, but there are plenty of families that seem to get through the process of raising children unscathed. They are going off to Harvard and Princeton, and there are no major traumas, and drugs have not, you know, invaded the family atmosphere, and everybody manages to get married before they're pregnant, and, you know, life is fairly smooth. How do you relate to families, or anybody relate to families that just seem to have gotten a better deal? And I say the only way you do it with yourself or with your children is to somehow try to get across to your kids, if you've gotten it across to yourself, that we're all enhanced when somebody succeeds.
Well, my kid once told me, he said, Dad, I have three objectives. He said, I want to be 21, have my own car, and live in California. And I said, David, that's exactly what I want for you.
And is he honest?
More than
poor
once.
California.
More than once.
Poor California.
A one-way ticket.
Oh.
California.
It works both ways. Let's be fair here and say that children don't have much choice in who they get for parents either. It's not over yet. I was coming up on the train with my daughter, Eliza, who's 17, and I don't quite
ouch.
Know. No, not ouch in this case. I'm going to miss her when she goes off to college, although we're in great fear and trembling as to which college will decide it wants her. But we were coming up on the train, and I don't honestly know how we got onto this subject, but she looked at me, and she said to me, Mom, you do realize that me and Justin and Christian love you, don't you? And I, it was so out of left field, and I looked at her and said, yeah, I do realize it. I think in her mind, she was beginning to see that she had kind of given me a lot of flack about all the ways in which I hadn't possibly been everything that a perfect mother should be. But I was very touched by that. It was like, you do understand, don't you?
That's interesting.
So it's starting to come back the other way.
Kids do have a tendency to throw a parent's flaws at them. I mean, they find little ways to needle you. They find little things that you do that probably aren't right, and they expand them.
I'm now beginning to feel like a kid advocate talking to you, but on the other hand, there have been times when I've realized I've been wrong, and not wrong in sort of small ways, like you did the dishes and he didn't do it at all, and I'm sorry about that, but larger things where maybe weeks have gone by and I haven't really paid enough attention or to one of the children, or I've been sort of unfair. And I find that when I sincerely apologize to any one of my children for myself or something I've done to them, they don't even want to hear it. They're extremely forgiving. Or they'd say, oh, no, don't worry. No, it's okay. When I put the shoe on the other foot, they are very full of absolution for me.
I guess when I was growing up, I kind of thought that my mother especially was kind of a nuisance to have around.
An embarrassment. I thought my mother was an embarrassment.
Well, she would embarrass me. She was a sneezer, and usually she would sneeze.
With or without a handkerchief?
Well, no, she would use a handkerchief, but usually it would be at the Thanksgiving table. You know, there'd be 20 people around, and
it would overcome her.
Her sneezing fits, you know. And I remember I was a kid, I just cringe, you know. How could she do that to me?
Yeah, I remember I didn't like, well, there are many things about my mother at a particular time in my life. I am crazy about my mother, but I went through an acutely embarrassed stage. Not with my father. I'm not sure. Little girls and fathers, I was never embarrassed by him. But my mother, everything about her suddenly was all wrong.
My father was an austere, mysterious person to me. He traveled a lot, and sometimes he would be away for a couple of weeks. And he would be gone in the morning when I got up for school, and he would work late.
Sort of like the Wizard of Oz. He was somewhere out there. He didn't, like Dorothy, trying to set out across the field of poppies.
But what a treat when he came back. I mean, sometimes at 8 o'clock in the evening, he would come home and get out of his car and be in the backyard throwing a softball or something. And I would play catch with him for about 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But what a thrilling thing that was, that little bit of time that he spent with me, because I never saw him very much when I was a kid. So he was a really, he was a mysterious figure that one respected. His word was law, still is.
I tell you, my mother thinks that most parents have a hard time letting go of their children at the very end. That she thinks it's the rule as opposed to the exception that parents hold their children in with an open palm as opposed to clutching on to them. And I was interested looking at Nightlights after it had been finished to realize that without meaning to, I had bookended the entire series of essays with the first essay on being born, where the whole theme of it was, particularly towards the end, on not letting go and being there for your little, my new little baby. And the last essay is exactly the opposite, learning you have to let them go if they're going to become attached to life as opposed to attached to you.
Did you ever live at home as an adult?
Not for any length of time. I'm the oldest of six, and my mother had her last child when I was a senior in college, so there was a big point spread there. And I went away to boarding school by the time I was 16. So really from the time I was 16 and to the present, I've never lived, you know, year in and year out at my house, at my parents' house. I had a nice thing happen last year. My mother came to stay with me for about two or three months. And it was the first time I'd had her all to myself, and I was really worried that it wouldn't work, that she would see all my faults and flaws and things that I could sort of hide from her when she lived at a distance in California. But that was so clearly what was not on her mind. It was really a wonderful time. I got a chance to ask her over a series of weeks and months about her life, and she had a chance to tell me about my life and how she saw me when I was a little girl, and it was quite wonderful. I think every grown child should have that. Somebody pointed out a sentence that she, in the book, that she very much identified with when I said, "Happiness is a house full of safe, inert bodies." And she said, "Here my children are, college and beyond, and they come home for vacation." And she said, "It's still, for me, happiness is still a house full of safe, inert bodies."
Well, to kind of wrap things up, one thing that does happen, and I've watched this, when your parents become old, as my parents they become more preoccupied with themselves and with their ailments and with the inevitability of their death.
Well, that whole middle element of life that you and I are still involved in, you know, getting and spending, is gone for them. They're concerned about there's birth, there's life, and there's death. Of course, they've now got their values straight.
Well, Nightlights is certainly a wonderful book to read, and whether or not it's a parent who reads it or a non-parent, I think it sheds a lot of light on life and relationship between children and adults. It's a very nice book, Phyllis DeRue. I want to thank you very much for spending this time with me.
Well, thanks for asking me. It was fun talking to you.